Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. Anyone who's standing may be seated. And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is Seibert versus Ali. And we will begin by introducing members of the court. My name is Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice. And the other members of the court will introduce themselves by seniority as to service on the court.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Jonathan Papik.
John Frydenberg.
And Mr. Shattuck, are you with us this morning?
I am. Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices.
And good morning to you. And Mr. Belmont, are you with us this morning?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Both sides of this argument have 10 minutes. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor, I understand the 10 minutes. I would ask that I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do that. With that, then, Mr. Shattuck, you may proceed.
Thank you, Justices. My name is Kelly Shattuck. I represent Ty Ali, Dr. Ali, who's the appellant and cross-appellee. This is an appeal that from a 2013 divorce that was filed in the County of Douglas. The final decree was entered on January 13th, 2020. The issues or findings of the court in a general manner were that there was no valid marriage in 1996, but there was a valid marriage in 2012. The court determined in this case that there was an argument about the putative marriage doctrine under Nebraska Revised Statute 42378. The court concluded that there was insufficient evidence under this doctrine to show that it should be used or declared. Further, the court determined, and this was not contested issue, custody to the mother. What was contested was there was a spousal support order of $5,000 per month for 60 months. They also divided assets generally along a 50-50 approach. Further, the court awarded attorney's fees to the wife of $50,000 and determined the value of Dr. Ali's business interest in his medical practice was consistent with his expert and a buy-sell provision of the operating agreement. We filed an appeal in a timely manner, and there's also a cross appeal that was filed by Ms. Siever. The alleged assignment of errors on our part, we alleged that the court erred when they included assets that we believe were independent of the marriage. They did not exist at the time of the filing. They were acquired independently after the filing by Dr. Ali. And our allegation on this is that there was not a rational relationship to the marriage. The second assignment of error alleged by Dr. Ali was the spousal support of $5,000 a month. He believed that this was an error from the court and that they had a sizable estate where each side was walking away with millions of dollars. Both the parties are physicians. and capable of earning sufficient income, including what they had. There was no house payment. The house was paid off. There was no car payments. Almost all the expenses that were shown were able to be handled through their own monthly amounts that they earned through their income. The third error alleged by us was an award of $50,000 of attorney's fees. And there was testimony on this that Dr. Sievert testified that she had previously paid all her expenses out of a joint account and didn't have the attorney's fees except for what was maybe included at the time of trial. We alleged that, again, that the estate was sufficient. Both parties were walking away with millions of dollars, and this was an error because it was basically double dipping, ordering him to pay attorney's fees that he had already paid out of a joint account. The fourth error that we allege in there was the children's tuition was being paid out of a joint account under both of their names. And this was split up by, we're alleging that the court also ordered my client to independently and solely pay for all educational expenses for the children, even though the account that was meant for that jointly attributable to the kids. So we're just saying that it should be paid. Our argument is it should be paid out of that joint account that already existed and not additional funds. So with that in mind, the law in this that we're relying upon is that there has to be a rational relationship on the first error that we've alleged to the parties. The appellee states that there is an irrational relationship in the fact that his client continued to work and take care of the children because she had sole custody during the temporary period. Our argument was that, again, this was an unusual case in the fact that it started in 2013, just a year after the finding of when they were married. And my client through the 2018 paid all expenses that he had previously paid, everything, kept everything up to date. All the assets that were previously owned by the parties were all in jointly owned by them. There was no disagreement about that. Any gains or losses were equally attributable to both of them. This was something that was independent that was started afterwards when there was not a timely solution, either through court because they couldn't, or settlement where they were unable to settle the matter in a timely manner.
So go ahead, Chief.
No, you may go ahead.
Don't our cases give district courts pretty wide latitude about selecting a date at which assets of the marital estate would be valued?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. And the general rule of thumb is that the court has wide latitude on determining the valuation date.
Have we ever said that it's an abuse of discretion to use the date of the decree or the date of the date of the end of the marriage?
No.
So this would be a first.
This would be a first. This is an unusual case in that, at least that I'm aware of, that's been published. This is an unusual case in that it went on for 7 years. There was no expectation that these funds that he was utilizing, and in fact the testimony from court was that he continued to pay everything up to $800,000 in additional expenses that wasn't ordered by the court. He paid off the house during this period of time that his wife was living in. He's paid her car, everything. But his expectation was he had to move forward with planning for his future. He was planning to retire. He decided to work extra time, and he socked this money away out of his own income on top of what he was already paying for support for the kids and his wife, and including what he was putting towards their estate. Again, he was adding to the estate as well during this period of time. He said he worked extra than he did. We just believe there's no rational relationship or there shouldn't be, there should be some type of rule where people are allowed to at least plan and move forward with their future, because they both agreed back in 2013 when this was filed that the that there was an irretrievably broken marriage, that they wanted it dissolved at that time, and none of these assets existed or were even on their minds at the time. They both thought they would have it resolved in a relatively smooth manner, which it didn't happen.
A couple times you mentioned that this was a sizable marital estate and that both sides came away with substantial assets.
Correct.
Even figuring in the attorney fee award of $50,000 that you're challenging and the obligation to pay children's tuition, do you have an argument that your client's receiving less than one third of the marital estate?
No, Your Honor.
And related to that, I had a question about the balance sheet in the exhibit to the decree that shows the equalization payments. It shows assets that are awarded, and then it shows an equalization payment. And then there's at the very bottom, there's a line that says debts. And then it says there's something like $4.4 million for Ms. Sievert and $6 million for your client. What's that bottom line referencing?
That was just a determination of what net it just determined what the net of the estate would be, Your Honor.
So is that indicating that your client received $6 million out of the estate and Ms. Sievert received 4.4?
No, they both received ultimately the almost exactly 50-50. The only disagreement was there was a cross appeal and there was a disagreement over the valuation of Dr. Alley's portion of his medical practice. And that was one of the cross appeal issues. But no,
why does it say 6 million and 4.4 then? I'm still not sure I understand that.
Whatever debts they had, there was a, for example, there was a debt on still on my client's house. We just determined what the net was. We just subtracted the asset from the debt on that, and that was what we did for all the assets, and that's how the court came to a determination. But generally speaking, how the court decided was exactly 50-50.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The other arguments that were made on this was that the appellee alleged that there was the putative merits doctrine should apply in this case. We disagreed with the punitive marriage doctrine being applied in this case. We pointed out, and the court agreed with us on this case, that they did not establish a marriage in any manner back in 1996. They didn't complete a marriage certificate. They didn't complete a marriage license. Neither of them had signed it. Both states require that the marriage ceremony take place with where the marriage license was obtained. The allegation originally was, in this case, that made by Ms. Sievert, is that they were not married in 96 when she originally filed, but were married in 2012. She refiled and amended that complaint and later said she didn't know why, under testimony, why she originally changed her mind on that. But when we looked at the facts, there was no evidence that they actually went through a ceremony. There was no evidence that they actually filed a license or even signed the license together. It wasn't, there was no witnesses. There was no memory of any of the names of any people that was there, and there was contradictory evidence. So we believe that shouldn't have applied. And then lastly,
I think your time has.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has run. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Belmont, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ben Belmont, and I have the honor of representing Dr. Patricia Sievert in these proceedings. I'd like to first clarify something, Justice. Professor Papik asked Mr. Shattuck. I believe the numbers were equal in 50-50 to the extent of what the marital estate as the court determined the date of marriage from 2012 to 2019. I'm not sure, and again, I don't recall why those bottom numbers were there, but I assume that there was an additional amount of money that Dr. Ali would receive value of items due to the fact that the court found the marriage is 2012 instead of 1996. So there was for 16 years, of which my client, my math is right, of assets that were accumulated that were not already held jointly. So I want to clarify that point. The response to the date of division, and the court's correct, it's got to be an abuse of discretion, clearly untenable. In this case, it certainly wasn't, considering it was a seventh, what the court did in finding that the marriage was in 2012. It determined the marital estate from 2012 to 2019. That was certainly equitable based on the facts in this case. In addition, when you're looking at determining the date of division, you need to look at what the joint efforts of the parties were. And while counsel can indicate that his client had the opportunity to sock away all this money, as he indicates, my client had the responsibility of continuing to care for the children almost exclusively and care for the home. In addition, when you look at the joint efforts of the parties, you have to consider how he got there. He, meaning Dr. Ali, again, Dr. Ali's now making $1.8 million. My client, I believe, is making less than $100,000, but only working part-time. So it certainly would be equitable to include the portion he was able to sock away in the marital estate. As to the issue of alimony, I mean, that's clear. There was no abuse of discretion under those circumstances. Again, Dr. Ali was making $1.8 million at the time and taking home $68,000 a month. I believe a $5,000 award of alimony for 60 months would certainly not be an abuse of discretion. As to
Mr. Belmont.
Yes, sir.
What effect would the putative marriage doctrine have on this case?
Judge, it would have between 1996 to 2012, so 16 years of, and that four children were born during the course of this marriage, because based on 2012.
So what effect does it have? I mean, as far as, is there an issue of alimony? Should there be more alimony, are you asking for? Or what effect does the putative marriage doctrine have on the determination of assets and alimony?
It wouldn't have much on alimony, but it certainly would have much on the division of the marital estate, because again, we're looking at retirements that were set from 2012 to 2019 instead of 1996 to 2019. I think that would be the greatest. Also, the valuation of his of some of the business assets that were acquired prior to 2012 that were excluded from the marital estate.
Mr. Belmont, can you give us a dollar estimate of what you think the difference was?
I can't, other than if you look at, we valued all the assets on exhibit number 38, and on exhibit number 38, it looks like when you look at other investments, you have a Morrowcroft special opt of $365,000 that wasn't included. You have I take that back. That was to be split. But I think it's mainly, Your Honors, that what the retirement accounts would be post or prior to 2000, 2012. So, and mainly, I think it's got to do with the children and acknowledging that the children were born during the course of this marriage. So that was the...
Your argument for the putative marriage doctrine, are you arguing that this case falls within the language of 42378?
Yes.
Or are you at... Okay, so 42378 talks about a marriage being declared a nullity. Do we even have a marriage here that was declared a nullity?
Sure. What we have, if you look at the statute, it says that the parties enter into a contract of marriage in good faith, supposing the other to be capable of contracting, and then the marriage is then declared a nullity. In essence, what the court did is declare the 1996 marriage that a nullity in essence. What the parties did was they went and got an applicant or a license in Douglas County. They're not married. They fly to Hawaii. Something happens in Hawaii. We think there's documents signed. We have argued, it's our position, a ceremony had taken place. They come back then to Nebraska, and everything then is both parties are acting as if they're married. They're filing joint tax returns. They're doing a loan application. They're doing their estate plan married. They're signing documents under, or Dr. Ali signing documents under penalty of perjury married. In fact, even while this case was pending, Dr. Ali claimed, and he was claiming he wasn't married, and that's part of the reason why this case took so long. He signed documents during that period of time that he was married. There's no question. Both parties had believed in good faith, because that's what their testimony was, that they were married. Look at the Hicklin case, which does cite that statute. Hicklin goes to a ceremony, but it also goes to good faith. And Justice Pavick, there's also a question of whose burden of proof was it in this case? And it is our position, I think, that it was the defendant's burden to show that there wasn't a marriage after this period of time.
Mr. Belmont, I'd like to ask you, with respect to the interpretation of Section 42378, which in the opening sentence talks about a party entered into the contract of marriage in good faith, do you believe that that language that I just quoted must be read in pari materia with the language in Section 42-104 that specifies how a contract of marriage is contracted in the state of Nebraska? In other words, to enter into a contract of marriage in good faith within the meaning of 42378, don't the parties have to comply with 42104?
If that were the case, Your Honor, then why would we need the good faith clause in there? Because if they didn't do something, and I didn't read 42104 before, but if they didn't comply with all of the requirements in 42104, then it wouldn't be necessary to put in there in good faith, how I would respond to that.
Well, I was just going to posit, suppose you have someone who solemnizes the marriage that's not authorized to do so. They purported to solemnize it, but it wasn't valid because of that. Wouldn't that be an example of exactly the interplay that I think the good faith clause would be getting to?
That would be one area, Your Honor, in which, sure.
What was the basis for the court's award of attorney fees to your client in the decree? Was it prevailing party or inability to pay?
I would assume the disparity in the earnings of the parties. The court never was specific in it. The fact that it was a 7-year marriage when in essence these two were together 23 years. with four children that my clients required that had almost exclusively exclusive custody over. So I believe that would be the basis. But getting back to the good faith portion, when the parties pulled an application in Douglas County, go to Hawaii, again, documents were presented, and we don't know, and a ceremony was held. I believe they required that that she complied with what was necessary under the putative spouse doctrine. In addition, the conduct of the parties, and they operated in good faith over the last 23 years. Your Honor, we would respectfully request that the decision of the district court be affirmed and modified to reflect that the marriage occurred back on June of 1996. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in Sievert versus Ali. Counsel, thank you for participating by WebEx today. You are now excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Lauder.